It's time for Radio Cals, a weekly program from the Central Arkansas Library System. Every Wednesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. here on KABF 88.3 FM, we will share with you conversations with interesting Arkansans on primary sources, Chewing the Fat with Rex and Paul, interviews with some of your favorite musical artists on Arkansas Sounds, content from the Butler Center's collections, information about what's happening in the library system, and much, much more. We invite you to let us know what else you want to hear by contacting us at radiocals@cals.org. This program is presented by the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies and the Cals Communications and Public Relations Department. For more information about Radio Cals, including links to resources mentioned in our segments, please visit the Butler Center's blog at butlercenter.org.
Hello, and welcome to Primary Sources, a featured production of Radio Cals. Here on Primary Sources, we focus on people who are making a difference in Little Rock and Arkansas. Some you might have heard of, and some you haven't heard of, but probably want to know about. Check out cals.org/podcasts for a free podcast of Primary Sources interviews.
Hello once again, everyone. I am Matt DeCampbell, and this is Primary Sources, a podcast of the Central Arkansas Library System, a continuing series where we talk to various Central Arkansans who are renowned for one thing or another, depending on their field, depending on their lives. And today we've got someone who's had a very interesting life, particularly in the last few months, in the last few years, and that's Miss Kara Brookins. Welcome aboard.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So you are first and foremost, obviously, an author, although you've also become a bit of a contractor in the past years, and we'll get to all that. But let's go backwards and start at the, you know, your childhood. Were you raised locally? What inspired you? What got you on your path?
Sure. I wasn't raised locally. I actually grew up in Toma, Wisconsin. So a bit of a transplant. I did move to Arkansas when I was 14 and graduated from high school in Searcy. Since then, though, have moved and lived all over the country, but keep coming back here. So I think it feels very much like home.
And I'm a transplant as well. I grew up in Seattle before I came down here.
So I knew there wasn't Arkansas in your voice.
Yeah, nor do you. Although it'll slip in.
It does. It
once you become an Arkansan, you find that you take home the y'alls and
which
the fixins.
And except if I try to put it on. You know, like
yes.
Every now and then you sort of wish you could affect a Southern drawl. I cannot do it then.
Yeah.
Completely.
I can only do it when I'm talking to someone else who has one.
Right,
yes.
Right.
And
which
you
it,
just.
It rarely serves you then. The only time it would serve you is if you're talking to people who don't have it.
Right.
And then you just can't do it.
But almost subconsciously, they just kind of, you just kind of pick up on what they're saying and it infects your own voice. So,
good
in a good
stuff.
Way. So, you graduated from high school down here.
I did.
And then sought to get away again immediately, or?
I lived in D.C. for a while. I lived down on the Gulf Coast. But my mother lived here in Arkansas, so I kept coming back for that, to bring my kids closer to her. And way back from the time I was in Wisconsin, you know, storytelling was a huge part of my life, and that followed me here to Arkansas and everywhere that I went. So, you know, that strain remained no matter where I lived. And eventually became the thing I wanted most in the world.
So what kept you moving so many times?
It was a variety of things, from work to, I got married right out of high school and moved to D.C. And then, of course, I kept coming back for my mom. So it was a variety of things.
And at what point was it when did you start writing, I guess, just should be the question straight up?
I started writing, I think the first book was published in 2003, and I wrote it a couple of years before that. So, you know, it was for my kids. I was telling a story to my kids, and that's how I started. And at that time, I didn't know any writers. I had never met an author. And I just thought publishing houses must just be dying for people to send them stories because there aren't any authors out there.
Right.
Certainly, if I'm not running into them, neither is anyone else.
Of course not.
What a silly thing. So I wrote this book, and I put the whole manuscript in an envelope and mailed it to a publisher in New York. And they called me in a couple of weeks, and they were like, hey, we like your book. We'd like to publish it. So I thought, well, that's easy. It was never that easy again.
Of course not. But even before you got into it as a profession, I mean, did you write a lot as a kid?
I didn't write. I read voraciously. Mm-hmm. And I was constantly listening to stories and telling stories. I wasn't a super confident writer because my spelling was atrocious and my handwriting was worse. So it really wasn't until I became more and more involved in computers that I gained the confidence that I needed for writing, which is such a silly thing, right? Because I think that I was a good storyteller and that it would have served me well to start writing sooner. But there was that bit of shame over what it looked like.
So you had concepts and ideas bouncing around in your head when you were younger, but you just never put them down to paper.
And I was always telling stories.
Right.
As well as listening to them, you know, asking my parents for stories, asking my grandparents for stories, the same ones over and over again.
What did your parents do?
My mom was a homemaker, mm-hmm. who finished college when I was in high school and became a clinical therapist.
Oh, great.
So she did mental health work.
Okay.
For the chronically mentally ill. And my dad worked in the lab of a plastic factory in Wisconsin.
So you're not in the family business.
I'm not. Although both of my parents read constantly, especially my dad, stacks of books from the library.
So what is it like? Obviously, you said it was easy the first time. But being an author, trying to find the magic, trying to find the niche. I mean, I've been to some local author events where I've seen you before. And, you know, they felt like everyone was trying to find, like, the next YA series. You know, they wanted to be the next Hunger Games. They wanted to be the next Harry Potter. They wanted to be the next one of those. Do you think a lot of authors trying to start out, do they write what they really want to write, or do they write what they think the market wants right now?
I think there's such a mix in that. It's just not the type of profession where you can do that sort of predictive plan when you write. There are some really smart business moves that you can make as an author, and I mostly learned them by doing the opposite and going, oh, that was a bad idea. For example, writing it across a bunch of genres really handicaps you when you're trying to market. Writing to a bunch of different age groups, which I think I've written all of them, handicaps you when you're trying to market. You know, so there are, and of course I have fiction as well as nonfiction. So, you know, those types of broad things, you have a hard time marketing that. But I do think that most authors ultimately write what touches them, what they want to write. And even if they started out trying to design something, you honestly cannot stick with it for that long. The amount of time and energy that you have to stick into a book for no money. I mean, you're doing this for free until you get paid.
It's all on spec.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So trying to stick with something that you're just pulling because you think it might be popular, I just don't think it works. I think that rarely can you put the heart and soul into it that you need to write something that you're proud of, to write something that you'll stick with. So by design or by accident, I think we all ultimately end up writing something that touches us.
So it sounds like that you do enjoy writing in the atmosphere that is the more insecure, as opposed to saying, Kara, we need a book from you. You know, you've got this deal with us. We need this book by X date.
Right. I think that's a great way to write. We need it by X date because generally then you're paid ahead of time.
Oh, that helps.
So,
yes.
Right. It's, you know, we're not all doing this for the money, but certainly we have to eat and live. So the money is essential. And if you know that there's already support behind a book, it's easier to bolster yourself on those tough days and to sit yourself down and make yourself write it on the days when you don't want to write. So I can do that. And I also like to dip in and write the silly things, and not necessarily, you know, that might mean it's a suspense or psychological thriller, but silly from the standpoint of it might not be exactly what my agent wants me to write. But I started very much writing for my kids, mm-hmm. You know, telling them stories. So as they grew up, I started writing things that were for older and older people until now I'm finally writing really exclusively for adults. And I love that. Like, that's the space I want to be in now.
And tell us about your kids, because we've referred to them and haven't said anything about them
yet. I have four kids, and they're fantastic. Now they are 26, 24, 20, and 11. Bold, courageous people who are doing some amazing things, running their own businesses. Mm-hmm. They have also moved around the country to Alaska, to Denver, to L.A., and they're pretty incredible.
So you write seven books, and then there's this eighth book. Where did you first feel like this is where your next project was going to go? I'm building this up slowly as though I were building a house, maybe.
Well, fiction was always my goal. Mm-hmm. I had never intended to write nonfiction. I had written nonfiction for the Democrat Gazette, you know, for the paper.
Sure.
I had never intended to write a book that was nonfiction. It wasn't until I was finished with the project that the book is about, until we had finished building a house, and that I kept running into other people who had gone through some really difficult times in their life. And while they had left or recovered from them, they were having trouble taking this next big step to do something different with their lives. So they were sort of at this launching point and couldn't make this leap. And I would start to tell my story and, you know, how my kids and I got out of this situation, and how sometimes doing something insanely big and unlikely is exactly what you need. You know, forget all those little steps. Mm-hmm. And I would see this transformation when I talked to people, and when I did motivational speaking, that I would see this change that my story was making in other people. And I thought, oh, darn it, I'm going to have to write this, mm-hmm. which was something it was tough. It was really tough to get that personal and to tell your own story. In fact, I worked on it for 6 years before I found, or rather gained the courage, you know, to tell it the way that it needed to be told.
So then let's back up. What was that, about 9, 10 years ago that it started? Why did you decide to build a house?
Well, I had been in a really difficult domestic violence situation. I had first married a man who, shortly after we married, developed a very severe form of paranoid schizophrenia, full-blown. My kids and I left that situation, but he continued to torment us for the next decade. So naturally, I was looking for some sort of security and safety. And I met a man who was physically strong and protective, and I thought, oh, this is just what I need, and got married. And he ended up being very abusive, physically violent. So by the time we left that and were on our own, you cannot imagine how broken and small we felt. We had been afraid, you know, for way more than a decade. And my kids were getting older. The oldest two were 17 and 15. And I had this sense of urgency that if I didn't do something, and if it wasn't big, I would lose them. They were going to move off into the world feeling that small. So we also needed a place to live.
And so it was necessity is the mother of invention, right? It was that.
Absolutely.
That's what settled you on that? Or is that something you had thought about just before in previous iterations of your life?
No, I had not really ever thought I'm going to build my own house someday. Never. No, it was certainly need. No, could we have bought something very small with the same amount of money and piled up bunk beds in the corners? Of course we could have. But that would have been a retreat. You know, that would have been more small living and more of the same example. And I wanted something bigger. And my kids, honestly, just wanted their own rooms.
Well, I was going to say, how on board were they from step one?
It's crazy how on board they were. And now when I evaluate it, I think, well, of course. I mean, they were kids. They thought their mother was sane with this idea. Mm-hmm. You know, they thought, well, of course their mother was going to lead them someplace that was safe and good. But I also think that this was the first time that they had the opportunity to take action. They had been in the situation where they were paralyzed and tiptoeing through their lives, and there was nothing they could physically do to give themselves a better life until this.
This is KABF in Little Rock, 88.3, the voice of the people in Central Arkansas.
More than 300 events, including story times, film screenings, book sales, concerts, lectures, and more, are happening at CALS. Pick up the Spring Programming Guide at any CALS branch or visit cals.org to view our full calendar of events. It's all here.
So I want to change the topic a little bit and it'll be a little meta, but it'll let you talk about something else for a change. I believe, since I've started hosting these, you are the first guest we've had on this podcast who has a podcast.
Oh, really?
So how have you seen the continued growth in podcasts? How have you seen that impact the world of literature and books? And how do you think it kind of fits into the bigger puzzle going forward?
Oh, gosh. You know, I am probably the worst person to try to evaluate this because I'm a podcast fanatic. So I don't know that anyone else consumes on the level that I do.
Okay.
So to me, it's, you know, extremely important. And I love to see my publisher, St. Martin's, but Macmillan did my audiobook. And they had invited me to do the podcast, Raise My Roof, which is motivational.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a space that they wanted to have more and more of their authors occupy to develop that platform. So I think that it's enormously important. And it gives, you know, authors as well as readers a place to meet the people who are telling the stories and, you know, to see this storytelling in sort of a nugget, mm-hmm. you know, while you're working out or while you're driving somewhere. So in my opinion, it's enormously important, and I love to see it getting more and more popular.
And two, it gives, again, getting kind of meta what we're doing right here, but it gives you the opportunity to tell your story as a conversation and not a soundbite.
Right. And to show how it affects so many different aspects of your life. How, you know, when you're writing a book, you're choosing which bits and pieces, of course, will fit into it. It's certainly not your entire story. And you're relating them very specifically to the things that are happening during that time frame. But when you're talking with another person, just having a conversation, you know, and something that's happening in their life relates to something that you did mm-hmm. 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's a completely different way to, you know, relate across time and space and to see the ways that things affect. So I think it's absolutely fantastic.
I almost broke my house once trying to replace a toilet, so we're not going to be able to have that conversation. What's the thing, because part of the reasons that we started expanding the podcast with the library system is to give people a wider range of stories and, you know, backgrounds and things that they might relate to.
Sure.
What, again, it may be tough to pick one since you're a huge fan of podcasts, but can you remember one specific topic or one broadcast or one podcast or one episode with a certain person that interested you in a direction you never thought you'd be interested?
Yeah, and this was really, of course, the first thing I listened to, which brought so many people in, was Radiolab.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the way they approached so many things, but I was already so interested in most of those topics that none of that was surprising. There was a podcast that when it started, it was about 7 minutes long. It was this really short thing, and then it grew, and it's 99% Invisible with Roman
mm-hmm.
Mars. So
yeah.
Now it's a big thing. But when I started listening to it, he was like, you know, just like recording it in his bedroom sort of thing. And, you know, it was about these architectural spaces. And that was something I had never thought about. And I mean, that's ironic because I'm building a house. But he was talking about, you know, public spaces
mm-hmm.
in a way that I had never thought of or thought that I could listen to for 30 minutes and find fascinating. Like he'll talk about highways, you know, or non-spaces, you know, open spaces or signs and somehow make that interesting.
And that's something.
I love it.
Yeah. And that's something I love about the format is that it's not a polished product before
no.
you can consume it like a book would be, like a TV show or a movie would be. You know, people are just putting it out there. And so even if you get into it later, you can kind of go back and watch and see how it's gestated and how it's.
Right.
And
right.
Have you found that with your own?
Oh, sure, sure. And I've only recorded, like, I think 11 podcasts, so
mm-hmm.
I'm still a baby at this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was never, like, a huge goal I had. I was sort of just thrown into it of, here, we want you to do this. And I was like, oh, okay, I like podcasts.
Sure.
And I found that I had never listened to them with the idea of hosting. So I was thrown into it as this extreme newbie, but I also went into that very comfortably going, so what? I liked listening to that. I liked listening to it where I could tell, yeah, they're still trying to figure this out. So that was okay. It's a very comfortable space to hang out in where you don't have to feel like, you know, I narrated my own audiobook too. Completely different feeling. You
mm-hmm.
feel like you have to be very precise and everything should be perfect and it's this polished, produced piece. Yeah, it's not like that with a podcast.
No, not at all. And I'm just the opposite of you. I specifically got interested in podcasts and jumped on this opportunity because hearing what people, particularly with comedic backgrounds, we're able to draw out of people in conversations just
right.
with your whether it's Marc Maron or Chris Hardwick or some of these others where it seems like that much more relaxed of a conversation because there's plenty of laughs in it. There's plenty, you know, they're generally, even if there's some very intense stories and very, very personal moments,
it's
mixed in with levity and everything else. So
yeah, it's real people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have that real comfortable space.
It's no filter.
Yeah.
Hashtag
yeah.
no filter. Yes. Have you now, okay, you said you weren't much of a television consumer.
No.
Were you already into social media, new media? I mean, obviously, if you're big in a podcast, you're online a lot. But is that something that there's been a curve for you on in recent years? Or is that something that were you an early adopter?
Well, of course, I was a computer programmer for 16 years developing software systems. So a bit of a geek.
There you go.
So definitely like social media, Twitter being a favorite.
Mm-hmm.
I spend arguably too much time on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. I do too. It's all right.
Though it may not be the best platform, you know, for everyone, certainly. I like the global appeal of it. You know, 75% of the people on Twitter are not in the U.S.
Right.
So the conversations are so much different than what you would have on Facebook, where it's actually more people that you know and are from a similar socioeconomic background, that sort of thing. So I enjoy that a lot. I have over 250,000 followers on Twitter, and I spend time there. I also do Facebook, and I've tried to leap into doing Facebook Lives and video.
Mm-hmm.
That's a harder thing for me to feel comfortable doing.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to get more into that. But I love social media. It's incredible. The friendships. Like, I've met people in person repeatedly from Twitter,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I first met there. And the friendships that you can develop in a few characters.
Well, I don't want to brag, but I broke 2,000 followers this a few weeks ago. Yeah, so I'm coming for you. Yeah.
2,000 is the number on Twitter because once you get over that, it's easier to gain followers.
Really?
Your ratio changes then.
Yeah. I was trying to be self-deprecating.
So,
okay.
No.
Well, then good for me, I guess.
Good for you.
Yeah. So what do you think? Do you think this is a point of a lot of debate all the time, and I don't want to get too academic about it, but social media expands the world but also isolates people because you can craft it so you're only surrounded by voices that are like yours, by people who you relate to the most. How do you think, you know, how do you think we get more people to approach it the way that you approach it, in that, you know, the curiosity and the wonder of this international conversation and seeing all pieces instead of just, well, this is a quicker way for me to get my own opinions reinforced fast.
And I understand the debate 100%, and it's so true, but I think that it's human nature,
mm-hmm.
For so many of us, and I think it just depends on your personality. And before social media was around, it was exactly the same. We were surrounding ourselves with a junior league group, or, you know, finding a smoking club or a quilting club. We were still categorizing ourselves in these groups that we felt comfortable in. And then there were other people who weren't, who were reaching out, who were traveling, who were talking to all different sorts of people. So I think that our natural personality is going to show through in how we approach that. To change and expand that is all about education and
mm-hmm.
the way that, you know, we're taught at a young age how to interact with other people and how we're taught to accept other people and to be curious about differences. For example, I got into a very lengthy discussion with someone who had a very different viewpoint with me on Twitter about the Earth being flat. They were a flat earther. And I immediately went, well, how does that work? You know, like, explain
right,
this
right.
to me.
How do you
Certainly,
come to that conclusion?
Right. And like, so tell me about the stars and the moon. Like, what are they to you? You know, not in any, you know,
no, genuine curiosity.
Way. Like, I just really want to know. And it became an impossible discussion to continue because of the people who would jump in. Because, of course, Twitter being a public conversation, you know, any of my 250,000 followers could leap in, and they did.
Yeah.
And most of them in a very negative way, you know, idiot, you know, name calling and just silliness. And I was like, well, I'm just genuinely curious. How does somebody come to this conclusion? And what are they using as supporting facts? And how do they see the world? You know, and as a storyteller, that's the first thing I'm thinking is, how do you see the world? So maybe that's the answer. More storytelling and more reading.
And more curiosity.
Yeah. And, you know, that is my one solution for education in the school system is curiosity. I don't think that we need to focus so much anymore on teaching the academics. You know, the school system was created so that everybody could have access to a math book and someone who knew how to solve the problems. Mm-hmm. You've got that now on YouTube. You no longer need a human to do that. You can learn absolutely anything, including how to build a house, by watching YouTube. Mm-hmm. So the only thing you need is curiosity. Now you can do anything. So if we can just focus, I mean, obviously the schools are put in place to try to teach these other things, and that's fine. That should be part of it. But if you teach that one thing, you succeed for the rest of that person's life.
So as we wind down, I'll just kind of give you the floor for a minute. And if you, and I'm sure this is something I'm sure this is something you talk about in your motivational speaking and everything. But if I'm listening to this podcast, mm-hmm. and I've been through some trauma, mm-hmm. whatever it is, how do I start? What's the first step that I take toward gaining control of it and, you know, empowering myself to not let it rule my life anymore?
You know, for me, the first step was to ignore all of the advice I read on the internet, which was the small stuff. It said, you know, just start small. Don't overtax yourself. Just get out of bed today. Make it your goal to make a pot of coffee. Make it your goal to put on your socks. And at the end of the day, I had a pot of coffee and some warm socks. You know, you're going to achieve whatever goal you set up for yourself. So set it crazy big. You know, look at it as an enormous leap. And go out there and absolute determination, push for something big. Push for something that changes your perception of yourself. And, you know, for me, it was building a house. For other people, maybe that's running a marathon, maybe it's climbing a mountain, maybe it's starting a business. Set that big goal and don't waver from it. If you try and fail, then try a different way. Don't change the goal. So that's what it was for me. And to know that if I, as you know, a small computer programmer and author can build a house, then anyone can reach their dream.
There's the button we'll end it on right there. Thank you for joining us. This is one of a number of podcasts that you can find on the Central Arkansas Library System website, which is cals.org, cals.org. And how do they find your podcast?
I am at Raise My Roof on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, everywhere.
Okay. And any other outlets you want to plug, your website?
My website is carabrookins.com. You can get to all of my social from there.
There you go. That's the way to do it. Okay. Well, thanks for being here. And thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next time on Primary Sources.
This has been a segment of an interview with Little Rock-based author and inspirational speaker, Kara Brookins. To hear this and other Primary Sources interviews in their entirety, subscribe to the Primary Sources podcast on iTunes or Google Play, or visit our website at cals.org/podcasts.
Radio Cals is a production of the Central Arkansas Library System and its Arkansas History Department, the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies. For more information, please visit cals.org and butlercenter.org. Our producer is Glenn Whaley, and our production manager is Brett Ratliff. Voices by Jasmine Jobe and John Miller. Engineering and editing by Brett Ratliff, Michael Stotts, and Anna Lancaster. Our executive producers are Leanne Blackwell-Hoskin and David Strickland. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next Wednesday at 6 p.m. here on KABF 88.3 Little Rock.